This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You bitch! No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little lassies of Prada, she's a me, honey.
John Callio, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curve?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for you.
We could have had a good life together. Fuck it, we were good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now, you broke my mouth.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9. And tonight, a really powerful show. So we're carrying on our look at intersectional identities by looking at the way that cinema has represented people who are queer, but people who also have disabilities. So we're going to be looking at some really powerful films. And it is just a small collection of films that we're looking at tonight, because Gina and Alan, there really isn't that much there.
Unfortunately.
No, there's not.
We know this to be true, yeah.
And I think, you know, there's very little, you know, queer film out there still, and that's what we talk about week on week. And unfortunately, I think what we've found through this process is films that represent people with intellectual or physical disabilities is even less.
That's right. And I think for a long time in Hollywood, it was taboo to actually represent people with disabilities, let alone in a sexualized way. And slowly in the last, I think, 10 to 20 years, there has been a crop of films dealing with people with disabilities in a sexualized way. Films like The Other Sister, a really wonderful film from Gary Marshall. Films like The Sessions with Helen Hunt and John Hawkes, and films like Me Before You. And we'll look at those films in a little bit of depth tonight, but we will also look at queer films which tackle the representation of people with disabilities. Films like Pulse, which screened at MQFF earlier this year, a really wonderful, powerful film to tackle the representation of people with disabilities. And we'll also be spotlighting a marvellous new documentary, really important and timely.
Australian documentary too.
From Sarah Barton.
That's right.
It's called Defiant Lives. And Defiant Lives is a new documentary featuring interviews with more than 30 of the leading disability rights activists over the past 40 years, plus more than, I think, 600 pieces of archival footage.
It's massive.
It's a big...
How they curated this, this is one of the things I definitely want to be asking Sarah when we speak to her later, so we're super lucky.
So we'll be speaking with Sarah Barton, the director of Defiant Lives, which opens in select cinemas later this month. We'll also be revisiting our chat with Daniel Monks, the writer and star of Pulse, later in the program as well. So a quick preface. Obviously, tonight we're not speaking about our own personal experiences. That needs to be said.
That's right.
What we're doing is making observations about the state of cinema today and the way that that represents people who are queer and have disabilities. And that's, you know, they really comprise a certain section of the community, a minority group unto themselves. And, you know, there has been actually, Gina, some research into the representation of queer people with disabilities.
Look, one of the best pieces of work that have come out, sorry, Screen Australia, but one of the best pieces of work for us, especially out of Screen Australia recently, has been the Seeing Ourselves report. And we've looked at it a lot here at Outtakes, especially because it's covered, well, the very low representation of LGBTQI characters. But it also touched on disability. Now, the statistics it found, so this was a report that basically was looking at TV drama, so we need to be specific. It wasn't looking at film, it was looking at TV drama. they themselves have come out and said, looking at all those statistics, looking at all those shows, disability is very much underrepresented in TV drama compared to the Australian population. 18% of Australians are estimated to have a disability. By comparison, only 4% of main characters in Australian TV were identifiably characters with a disability. That statistic, appalling, absolutely appalling. I mean, the statistic that came out of LGBT representation was 5% to 11% of the population.
So 11% of the population
for LGBT
is
representation, whereas when we're looking,
of characters on TV,
4%, yeah, for LGBT. Sorry, numbers flying at us everywhere,
flying all over the room.
So you know,
So in a sense, you'd say that that the queer community was represented.
It's kind of half. Well,
in a higher proportion.
Than this. Yeah. So,
you would think that if you're 20% of the population, we would be seeing 8 to 10%.
I'm going to give Screen Australia a lot of credit here and some of the funding bodies, because I'm seeing the kind of initiatives that are coming out of this report. This report was essential to say, here are the statistics. We need to be accountable. We can't just say, oh, I can't think of a film. You know, here is the stats, and they're out there now addressing this slowly. But they're addressing
this. Well, that's
this.
Right. I mean, we need to know what the problem is before we can address the problem. And we've always suspected that there was a problem in relation to representation. Mm. What Seeing Ourselves did, and we looked at the report in quite some depth when it came out, but what it did is it lent support to the proposition that there was a problem.
Yeah.
Interestingly, and I think there were certain limitations around the report, as there would be with any report, but we don't actually know what percentage of representation actually spotlights queer people with disabilities. Mm. That's not something there's been a lot of research into. Our take from surveying a broad range of films is that it would be minimal.
Yeah.
Look, in TV, they did cover Please Like Me, which is an amazing Australian TV show, which goes across both of those. It was the only one they could reference in that space, so which covers both LGBT issues and disability as well.
And you know what? It's even worse in the States. I have a stat here from GLAAD's report from 2016, Where Are We At on TV? Mm. And even though they're not looking at specifically queer representation of people with disability, but just in general, they found that only 1.7% or 15 characters from all of the television in the US were people who were identified with a disability.
Mm.
So we're doing better than the US by that statistic. They're 1.7% and we're 4. So it's not much, but we're doing better. But there's still plenty of room for
improvement. Huge room. And that's the thing. Good on you, Screen Australia, seeing the initiatives that are coming out, looking to develop developers, looking to develop storytellers, to come out and learn how to tell these stories. These are some of the initiatives I'm starting to see come out there and make these changes by training up
the really interesting thing that Seeing Ourselves showed as well was that advocacy counts.
Yes.
That when you push for representation, representation actually can increase.
Yeah.
And I think one of the really interesting things about Defiant Lives is that this documentary that we're going to be exploring later in the program is that it explores advocacy in relation to people with disabilities. And I think what we need to see is a bigger push, more advocacy for greater representation of people with disabilities on the screen, full stop. But also, how wonderful to see more representation of queer people with disabilities. Mm. And we're going to be exploring some of the films that do a really good job of representing queer people with disabilities. But first, we're turning our attention to some films that at least give some kind of sexual nature to people with disabilities. One really great example is a film called The Sessions with Helen Hunt and John Hawkes.
Daniel, I haven't actually seen that film, sadly. I know you passed it over to me, but I did tell you before that I haven't actually seen that film. Whereas, I'll have to pass on that one.
We're deferring back to you, Daniel.
Yeah, back to you.
Well, what about a film like The Other Sister? This film is directed by Gary Marshall. It stars Hollywood royalty Diane Keaton and features a really wonderful, endearing, kind of heartwarming relationship between a character played by Giovanni Ribisi and a character played by Juliette Lewis, and the two kind of engage in this relationship. They are both mentally handicapped, and they engage in this relationship. And what the film is showing us is that people with disabilities can engage in relationships like anyone else, which sounds obvious.
Yeah.
But, of course, Diane Keaton plays this, you know, the mother of Juliette Lewis, who's
smothering mother,
who doesn't believe that her daughter can have this kind of relationship like everyone else.
I think that film had just as much to do about that struggle for independence that all young people experience as it is with the sexual relationship. I think,
but that was
here
the
was a mother and family struggling to let go.
But that was the wonderful thing about the film. What it did was represent people with disabilities in the same way as it would represent anyone else, which is exactly what we need to see more of in cinema. And there's that wonderful scene where the character that Juliette Lewis plays actually kind of says as much to her mother, played by Diane Keaton.
Carla, just wait a second. I just want you to understand. Carla,
what?
Listen to me. Listen.
What?
It's not that I don't like Danny. It has nothing to do with whether I like Danny or
yes,
not.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't.
What's wrong with him, Mother?
Nothing is wrong with him, Carla. He's fine. He's perfectly fine. I'm just asking for you to wait. Danny's the first boy you've met, and I think you can do better.
No, but I can't do better because I'm not better.
You're better. You're better.
Stop
You're
touching me.
Better.
I'm not a baby. No, I'm not better. I'm just me, Mom. And no matter how long I wait, I can't be a painter and I can't play tennis and I'm not an artist.
Okay.
But I know how to do some things.
Yes.
And I can love. And I love Daniel. He loves me very much.
I know he does, but Carla, I just don't think that he can take care of you. He can barely take care of himself.
We can take care of each other. We don't need you, Mother. But don't worry. You don't have to come to my wedding. I'll do my own wedding.
Oh, wow. That gives me tingles, goosebumps all over.
It's such a kind of endearing film, and I think what it does so well is show us that. I mean, it sounds so kind of obvious to say, but like people with mental disabilities love in the same way that everybody else does.
That's right.
And I think Defiant Lives, the documentary that we're exploring later in today's program, actually picks up on that.
Brilliant.
There's this wonderful moment where there's this this lady who has been kind of kept in this kind of institution, and she, do you remember that scene? She had her babies taken away from her, and she's still today kind of searching for her child.
Yeah.
And it's just this kind of gut-wrenching moment.
And I think that sort of characterises a lot of what happened in those institutions at that time. These people were dehumanised, and they weren't recognised at all as actually having the capacity to love and to feel and to think and I think at times they were infantilized and made other, and I think that comes out very clearly in the film where they're treated as the other so well.
Well, we are looking at, we'll be speaking with the filmmaker of Defiant Lives later. And if you have any questions or would like to join this conversation, please message in on 0427JOY949 or email us on air at joy.org.au.
And while we're spotlighting this wonderful film from Gary Marshall that came out, I think it was about 1999, The Other Sister with Juliette Lewis and Giovanni Ribisi, and you're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where tonight we are looking at films that represent queer people with disabilities, but we're also looking at the way that cinema has represented people with disabilities more broadly. And one really great documentary to spotlight, I think, the kind of rise of disability activism, amongst other things, is the new documentary from Sarah Barton.
So Defiant Lives is an Australian documentary which documents the rise in the fight of the disability rights movement here in Australia, in the UK and the USA.
And we're joined on the phone by Sarah now. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's lovely to be well, not really there, but almost there.
Sarah, I think you're in good company. I think we've all got sniffles and snuffles here. I think there's a bit of a cold epidemic floating through Melbourne.
Mine was something a little more debilitating this morning, but okay. We won't go into that.
No worries. Me jumping to conclusions and assumptions. Sarah, Defiant Lives is not the only film that you've made on this issue. You've also made a film back in 1994 called Untold Desires, looking at sexuality and disability, which was just something that we touched on a little bit earlier on the show. Could you tell us a little bit about that documentary?
Well, yes, that was my first film, and that was a story that I felt I wanted to tell, and it was, relatively easy to get SBS on board because SBS is, the sex channel. So.
especially back then, it was known for that, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, everything, if you did a documentary about sex, then there was really no question about it. So I was deluded because Untold Desires was remarkably easy to get funded, but I actually think it was a sex factor. But I thought, the next 25 years or so that, it was actually that there was an interest in disability. So Defiant Lives certainly was a much trickier project to get funded, but hopefully it will, attract a similar, large, broad audience and people who really have never really thought about disability from a rights perspective before.
Yes, I think this comes out very clearly in the film about that very fact, about how most of us, most people in the community who don't have a disability probably have never had this issue brought to their attention. And I think Defiant Lives really makes that very clear about such a long process and also some very significant early wins. I mean, this is something that really stripped my ignorance away.
Yeah, well, I wanted to make a film about disability that people wouldn't sort of avert their eyes from. I think a lot of people have a kind of thing of, disability and death, let's not go there unless we have to, and let's kind of avoid it. And so I wanted to step away from the sort of, inspiration and tragedy and all of those sort of, personal stories and really talk about disability from a rights perspective and in a way that people could feel more empowered watching it. So people aren't just, to be fair, there is a little bit of tough viewing in the film, but as a whole piece of cinema, I really wanted the film to be something that people could come away with some empowerment, a sense of like, I can do things differently. I can make a contribution to a more inclusive society. It's down to all of us. So the overarching kind of pull of the film is really to try and get people to think differently about disability, to move away from the sort of diagnostic medical model and to think about us all living amongst each other. And whether we have an impairment or not, we should all be, socialising, working, being each other's partners. There really should be much more sort of interconnectedness, and that's what I really want from the film.
Sarah, I think that really came across, especially hearing it straight from the advocates themselves telling their story. Now, what I wanted to know, you started this film in 2010, is that correct? So 7 years ago.
I actually got my first little bit of development funding from Film Vic in 2008.
Oh, God, so even longer.
Yes.
But you speak to 30 activists in this, and what people will, when they kind of look at it, I've read that there's over 600 pieces of archival footage in this. So the empowerment for me was definitely listening to the activists themselves. The stuff was gut-wrenching, was looking at some of that really old archival footage to think, oh, my God, that's how we treated people. How much footage did you end up in total? Like, this is a long process. How did you get to this point here to go, right, here's an hour? Because I can imagine this is probably a much longer story. How did you select those interviews and how did you select that footage and keep it within an hour's film?
It's an hour and a half, it's 85 minutes. And, we wanted to do a feature documentary and we actually did 14 rough cuts.
Wow.
So my editor, Bert Murphy, we worked over and over and over and we restructured and we showed it to a lot of friends. And, we got feedback, which is pretty hard when you know you've got something that looks a bit crap and isn't working, to go to your documentary colleagues and say, look, this is what we've come up with so far. What should we be doing better? That's a hard process. But we knew we had to do that if we were going to get the story right. So really then everything became what serves the... Once we found that overarching narrative, every piece that went into the film had to serve that overarching narrative. And that means there is a lot of stuff that is left out.
Ooh,
I think
hard.
That this is a film, this is a first film about disability rights, and I would hope that there'll be a whole collection of other documentaries that tell it from different perspectives.
We are speaking with Sarah Barton. Sarah is the director of the new film Defiant Lives, which will be opening in select cinemas around the country later this month. More with Sarah right after this.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, the home of queer cinema. And we are spotlighting films that represent queer people with disabilities on tonight's program. We're also looking at the way that cinema has more broadly represented people with disabilities, and a fantastic new documentary to spotlight the rise of disability rights and the rights movement is Defiant Lives. It's opening in cinemas later this month, and we're joined still on the phone by Sarah, the director of this powerful new documentary. So thank you for sticking around, Sarah.
It's a pleasure.
Now, Sarah, earlier we were talking about how much work and footage has actually, you know, how much story is actually in this. And I can only imagine how difficult it is. I mean, you're getting feedback from your peers, but the footage and the interviews are so important, having to decide what's shown, what you don't show. What is it like, though, then sharing that finished product with some of the activists that are in the film? What was it like showing them this story?
Look, I think the first couple of times it was a little bit nerve-wracking because it's like, oh, gosh, I hope they like it. I haven't spent 8 years of my life to make something that's a bit meh, you know. But once I got a sense that people were really responding extremely positively, then I was able to relax a lot more and feel... I mean, I loved the film. I was happy with what I'd done. I know the sort of constraints and the shortcomings that we were dealing with. And, you know, and I think that it's, you know, it's something I'm very proud of. But it's just lovely to get those activists come on board and say, yes, we love it. This is, you know, this is exactly the film we were hoping someone would make.
Oh,
so, you know.
Now, in an ironic kind of twist, Sarah, I was reading up on the film's premiere earlier today. And I think
he chuckles knowingly.
I think you've probably spoken about this a little bit, but I think it's kind of ironic in a really pertinent way when we're talking about representation. People in wheelchairs were very limited in their ability to attend the film because cinemas simply couldn't cater to them. I mean, I think that says a lot about the timeliness and importance of the documentary.
Yes. Well, you know, most cinemas around Australia would have, you know, between 2 and maybe at the very outside 6 standard wheelchair places. We had a premiere at the Sun in Yarraville last year where they took out a row of seats. So we were able to get 15 wheelchairs into their, you know, their main cinema. So that was great. But a lot of cinemas can't do that. And I think, you know, we were... you know, I think the Sydney Film Festival was a little bit taken aback by how many wheelchair users wanted to come and see the film. and look, to be fair, you know, I was busy and I didn't sort of feel like I needed to sort of hold their hand and make sure they get it right. Perhaps in hindsight, you know, once they selected the film, you know, I should have gone into overdrive to support them a bit, but I didn't really feel like it was my job, really, you know. So it was, you know, I mean, I feel, yeah, it's just one of those things that it really does highlight the real problem of, you know, just a limited number of wheelchair spaces in cinemas. And look, we're trying our best with the cinema release of the film, but inevitably there are some cinemas that we're screening the film in that do, you know, have pretty limited wheelchair spaces. So if someone is in a wheelchair and they want to come and see the film, they need to book early to ensure that they get those wheelchair spaces. But, you know, we're doing our best.
Yeah.
And the other thing around access that we've done, all of the screenings will have open captions, so hearing impaired people can read the captions. And we also have this fantastic movie reading app, which has the audio description on it for people with vision impairments. So people can go to the App Store and get this app called Movie Reading. And once you download that, you'll see Defiant Lives. And you can download, there's 2 files, you can download those. And then when you get to the cinema, it just syncs up with the film, but you know, the phone, this through your smartphone, and you can hear the audio description, but it's not there for everybody else who doesn't need it.
So, Sarah, can I just also say another brilliant thing I saw on the website, the official website for Defiant Lives? It's even got all these accessibility apps built into the website. So depending, you know, so that you can even find out more about the film. You've even taken that into the film's website. So brilliant.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Loved it.
I've done a lot of accessible websites, so I know that, that stuff's really important.
But the reason why I thought it was really pertinent was because one of the things the documentary does is moves through all of these kind of models of disability and the way that we think about disabilities, and it kind of finishes up, I think, with this social kind of model of disability. And I think a lot of what that model has to say about disabilities and the way that we think about disabilities as more of a social problem, you know, it's not the people with disabilities who are the issue, it's society and the fact that we don't, you know, really cater as well as we should for people with disabilities. That is made plain by this kind of issue with cinemas.
Absolutely, yes, yes. It's a very pertinent example of what's going on actually in the film. So, yes, you're absolutely right.
And I love as well that the film deals with advocacy and with the kind of rights movement. And here on Outtakes, one of the kind of things that we're acutely concerned with is the need for representation, and representation being a kind of base on which kind of advocacy can grow, because, you know, people need to see themselves and people need to see each other before you can start talking about building certain rights. What are your thoughts on the state of cinema and the representation of people with disabilities?
Still got an enormous way to go. Mm-hmm. I started a show on Channel 31 Community TV way back in 2003 called No Limits, where people like Stella Young got their start on television. Mm. And, you know, that was, what's that, 15 years ago now, nearly, not quite. And, you know, we were putting people on screen every week, you know, people with disability. And it was a revelation then. But I don't know that we have gone much further beyond a certain sort of tokenism. And then I think you have a lot of issues where filmmakers aren't quite sure of the social model. They create characters that perhaps, you know, are just a little bit, you know, a bit on the nose in terms of what the advocacy sector would like to see. And, you know, that's a sort of delicate balance between the sort of creative process and the sort of advocacy process. And you know, filmmakers shouldn't always expect to be advocates, but I think when they can become really well informed, then they can do better representation. And the other issue, of course, is, you know, authentic casting of disabled people in roles, you know, in disabled roles.
Well, I was actually just going to ask you about that. I remember when Glee started some years ago, of course, there was a character in a wheelchair, and there was a bit of an uproar that the character was played by someone who didn't need a wheelchair, and it was said that someone in a wheelchair should be playing the character in a wheelchair. What are your thoughts about casting in that respect?
Look, I think casting people have a million excuses as to why, you know, they might need to cast you know, an able-bodied person. That might be to do with, you know, the difference, you know, certain scenes where the person has to be both disabled and able-bodied.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the star pulling power of actor, you know, star actors that don't have disabilities that, you know, can get a show kind of an audience and that sort of thing. So they've got all of these excuses. But I think really, essentially, those excuses amount to a sort of lack of commitment and a real lack of understanding of the issues. And, you know, now we're starting to see, you know, a small handful of disabled actors who kind of, you know, have their own star status. And if you don't actually cast people, then those actors don't develop. So, you know, I don't take much about the excuses. I mean, there's all this sort of CGI effects that you can do to, you know, put someone in a different space. Why not use CGI to get a disabled actor to walk, you know, for a scene if they have to?
Excellent point.
Yeah, that is a very good point. And I think it's interesting how we're talking about this subject. And for me, the name that comes into my mind is for me to actually see someone on screen with a disability was Marlee Matlin, who won the Academy Award back in 1987 for Children of a Lesser God.
That was decades ago.
But isn't it an issue that your reference is such a
that's the
with
point.
Due respect, Alan, an outdated reference because you know.
Yeah, but she was one of the most familiar faces across television in the USA was cast appropriately. But one name. That's it. We're pulling one name. And it just shows you how much work needs to be in this landscape.
That's right.
Well, now we've got RJ Mitty, who played the son in Breaking Bad, and the actor, I can't remember his name, who plays in Speechless, which is a great little sitcom if ever people can see it. It sort of came and went very quickly on Channel 10, but it's really fun. So, there's a little handful, but I just think there needs to be a major commitment to authentic casting, not only in Hollywood, but I think also the Australian cinema sector or, film and television sector could really, engage more deeply with the issues. And I think, there's some tentative steps to try and do that. And I think,
But that's educating our storytellers as well and when they're writing these stories. And I think that's the really good work that Screen Australia are starting to do and that Seeing Ourselves report is helping. In starting those correct conversations, saying, well, why, when you're telling the story, what is the story you're trying to tell and why? Being mindful of that as well.
But
and it's like, I was just going to say, is it a story if there's no disability involved? Mm. That's often a way we look at stories. It's like, with a lot of the sort of inspirational stuff that's online, boy goes to, formal, disabled boy goes to formal with, or those kind of things. And you go, is that a story if there's no disabled person involved? Actually not. Mm. So it's not a story.
But the other really interesting dimension as well is clearly there are really important social reasons for better representation. But, as we've seen, it also makes business sense. If 18% of the population are disabled in some way, it makes real business sense to represent disabled people because there is an audience for it. I mean, apart from the fact that everybody should be tuning into this kind of material.
Well, that's one of the things, interestingly, that you should mention that, I've been sort of banging on a bit about behind the scenes in that, you've got a government that's spending, $6.4 billion or something on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, but they also need to be sort of, putting some pressure onto, agencies like Screen Australia and the state agencies and that fact. Cinema and film and TV is a great way of moulding how we see ourselves.
Exactly.
And if there's modelling, done through our film and television industry, that flows through into the way, people who might be using the NDIS can be included in society. So I think it's really crucial that two departments that might look like they have absolutely nothing in common. But in actual fact, if Screen Australia starts doing these initiatives and really, pushing for greater inclusion, then there's actually a benefit down the track to the bottom line that's the NDIS. Mm. So it's actually about looking really holistically across government and sort of saying, if we've got this great authentic representation of disability on our screens, that's going to pay dividends. Mm.
Look, it's been so fascinating speaking with you this evening, Sarah. Congratulations on this really timely and important documentary. Mm. It is screening in cinemas later this month, select cinemas around the country. And congratulations again.
Oh, thank you so much. Can I just say, 15 seconds worth of the way that we're booking the cinemas, we're using a company called Demand Film, which means that people need to book their tickets in advance. And enough people book a ticket, then, the screenings go ahead. So just be aware and do a little bit of, looking around online at the way that the model that we're using.
So, Sarah, for people who do want to book tickets, and we strongly encourage people to book tickets to this film, it is an important documentary, whereabouts online should people go?
Okay, so the ticketing site is demand.film and then look for Defiant Lives. They've got a lot of films on their page, but Defiant Lives is there. Or if you just want to go and have a look at our site and look at the trailer and everything, just go to defiantlives.com and then you can click on cinema screenings and that'll take you through to the demand booking site as well. So there's a lot of information about the film on our website, which is defiantlives.com.
Well, we're going to play the trailer to Defiant Lives now, Sarah. So thank you very much again for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I'm tired of all the well-meaning non-cripples determining what I can and cannot do. to form my life and my future. Get out of our way.
It was bashing something you ever saw in
there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A lot.
Nobody wants to live or go into a nursing home.
Nursing homes are jails for people. They're jails. They're warehouses. They're where America has decided to stick its disabled people and let them rot until they die.
Sooner or later, you have to come up with the proposition that these issues are political.
And I think for many people, it was just the most exciting thing that ever happened to them in their whole lives.
We had this two-day action where essentially almost everybody just got arrested.
I can tell you, the outrage of disabled individuals across the country is going to continue. It is going to be ignited.
We aren't asking for civil rights. We're demanding of them now.
The idea that you can focus on society as the problem rather than impairment or a condition is a radical idea.
There's this famous catch cry on disability, and it's nothing about us without us. When we're involved and included in change, that's when good change happens.
This is about everybody. We're socialised into the assumption that if I become disabled, I don't want to live. That's all very well. When you become disabled, chances are your life will seem completely different.
Well, that was the trailer for Defiant Lives, the new documentary showing in select cinemas around the country later this month. And speaking with Sarah, I mean, how fascinating.
Look, I remember sitting and watching this documentary going, oh, my God. I mean, so much of that historical stuff we know. And it is hard, but you do need to watch. You don't just turn
sometimes
your eyes off to
it. It's not easy to watch all of it.
No, it was confronting.
It was really confronting.
At places, yeah.
But how empowering listening to those adverts, you know, just say, no, this is what we want. Don't you tell us what we want. We're going to tell you exactly. And it was I loved every single one of those interviews. That was the thing. So each time, you know, and you kind of went through waves where they're telling you different parts of history in the UK, USA, and here in Australia.
Yeah.
But you needed those advocates to kind of wake you up and go, now, but this is what we wanted here and this is why we did it. And God, it was brilliant.
But I think there was one common thread through all of that, and that is all of those advocates were demanding it now.
Yeah.
We will not wait. And, you know, I was so impressed by that. That just blew me away.
Mm.
Well, we are looking at the representation of people with disabilities in cinema tonight on Outtakes. Coming up right after this, we're turning our attention to some films that have gotten it spot on right in relation to the representation of queer people with disabilities. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where we are spotlighting tonight the way that cinema has represented people with disabilities, and in particular queer people with disabilities. Now this is Blink by Denny featuring Afir, and this is part of the soundtrack to a really powerful film that screened at MQFF earlier this year. The film is Pulse, written by and starring Daniel Monks, and we actually spoke to him at the time, but of all the films to kind of deal with queer characters who are disabled, I think this is up there as one of the best, if not the best.
So to remind everyone, because we did cover this quite a bit with MQFF, but Pulse is about a gay disabled teenage boy who changes into the body of a beautiful woman so that he can be loved. So clearly it kind of suspends you, it requires you to suspend disbelief, but it is a very powerful and controversial film. And controversial films.
Why do you think it's controversial? Is this because of the gender bending that goes on?
It is, and because I don't think it was telling that story. And I think when we kind of looked at this film, this was a self-funded feature film that took years to actually make. And the dialogue and conversation and the language has changed quite a bit in our community. And I remember
that's around transgender.
Yeah,
language.
And some of the language that's used in the film, but it's a very powerful, it's a very strong film, and it's a film about Well, it is a love story, and it is a film about, it's a coming of age story, but it's just told that little bit differently.
But it's a fantasy.
It's a fantasy world.
It's a fantasy construction. It's about what life could be.
So we sat down with Daniel around around the time that the film showed at MQFF. It has, of course, subsequently screened as part of the Sydney Film Festival, which was fantastic. And this is part of our chat with Daniel.
Daniel, when you put together a film like this, I mean, the film does deal with a lot of edgy themes. Do you have any reservations about making a film like this?
Totally. I mean, as a disabled person, and then also as a gay person and a queer person, those different, being part of these different minorities, those minorities are so often underrepresented, and so you really feel like you want to represent them as well as possible. But at the end of the day, what I tried to focus on in creating it was just being as true to my story as possible, and hopefully that if I tell my story truthfully, then hopefully it might resonate with others, because I can't tell everyone's story, only my own.
Well, Daniel, there's no doubt that representation is critical. We know that seeing ourselves on screen is vital. Perhaps if we take a step back, tell us what Pulse is actually about.
Absolutely. It's about a gay disabled teenage boy who, through a full body transplant, changes into the body of a beautiful woman so that it can make his straight best friend fall in love with him.
What a premise.
You know, just a little rom-com of Tinsel. No.
Exactly.
You know what? I think that's a common young gay boy fantasy. In fact, I think I might have had exactly the same one, same thought once or twice.
I did as well.
When I was a teenager.
But what I loved about this story is it really is about the interiority of the characters and also about the relationships between the characters and the actual transformation, this kind of fantastical transformation that the lead undergoes.
Yeah.
It's not a focal point of the film, is it? I mean, it's the consequences of that transformation that's at the heart of the film.
Totally. Well, like, we wanted to kind of take the fantastical sci-fi approach without making a sci-fi film, and we looked at a lot of references like Charlie Kaufman and Eternal Sunshine and those type of things, because it was less so about just changing from male to female and more so about wanting to be someone else, because coming from a place of self-hatred and feeling like if I'm someone else, then I can achieve the love that I want so badly.
And
so it's a very light, funny film.
And it's that thing, I mean, as storytellers, we want our audience to suspend disbelief. I mean, you take it to that next level where you really want your audience to suspend disbelief.
Totally.
And then keep going on the story. And I think it actually achieves that.
It does.
That.
It works.
And it achieves that with the physicality of the two actors playing the one role almost.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, because when I was researching and looking into your film after I'd watched it, it seems like this was a self-funded project. Is this what has taken so long to see the full picture on screen that we're seeing now?
Yeah, so we all self-funded, and also through crowdfunding, we had a possible campaign, which is really helpful. But it's that thing where with micro-budget filmmaking and films that we really didn't want to compromise on our storytelling and on how potentially provocative we are in telling the truth. And so we wanted to get this made sooner rather than later. And so we decided to go independently financed in terms of ourselves and then crowdfunding with friends and family. But we also had an incredible post-production house that came on and have done all the post-production as an investment in the film, Sandbox post-production in Perth. But it's been it's really hard to get a film made, and it's a long, long process, and it's hard to keep up the steam to do it. But I guess for myself and the amazing director, Stevie Chris Martin, what kind of kept us going was that we hadn't seen a film like this, and if I had thought for this film when I was a teenager, I think it would have had a positive, strong impact, and so kind of we hope that this might furthermore have an impact on others in a positive way.
I actually did want to touch on that, Daniel. Now, we're quickly running out of time, but as a kind of final question, I would love to know, you know, we know representation is important, and what one of the really wonderful things, you know, I can't understate how important it is. This film does deal with disability and with queerness, and to see both of those things on screen together is really important. Tell us what it means to have this on the big screen.
It means everything, because when I was growing up, and so I was completely physically able, and then I acquired my physical disability when I was 11, and suddenly starting puberty, realizing I was maybe gay, and then also becoming suddenly disabled, I felt so other, and I felt so alone in my struggle. And I remember I used to watch gay short films on YouTube and delete my web browser history and my parents' door.
We've all done that, don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. But that was such a huge thing for me, and it really helped me accept my sexuality. But I had never seen a film about disability that I felt, especially being disabled and a young person, that I felt really spoke to my experience and my struggle. And that's why it's been so beautiful to make it. And also, now I am a part of the disabled community and showing it to other disabled people. One of the greatest rewards for me personally is hearing their responses and that it rings true to them. And, it's very special.
Daniel, I just wanted to say, when I watched that film, the shots early on in the film with you as a young boy going through surgery in hospital, I thought that was incredibly intimate and very authentic. And I guess my heart went out to you in those scenes, and I think that really made me relate to you and this character throughout the story. Look, it's such an important film, Daniel. Well done. The film is Pulse.
Thank you so much.
It's well deserved because it's about time we saw these stories on the screen.
Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. joy.org.au for the world.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we've been looking at the way that cinema spotlights people with disabilities, and particularly the way it represents queer people with disabilities. And just before those messages, that was a recap from our MQFF special, which was live from ACME, hence all that kind of background noise. But that was our interview with Daniel Monks, the writer and star of Pulse, which is amongst the best films to represent queer people with disabilities.
I'd agree with you on that one, Daniel. And you know what an amazing young man is Daniel. And that film is such a great film. Mm. It has got a lot of, you know, listening to that back again, I think in many ways Daniel Monks, the writer, was actually sugarcoating the rawness of his own feelings. I mean, that really came through, talking about how he felt other and alone and dealing with his self-loathing. And I think what he's done in Pulse is he's actually translated that into this fantasy, but it's still there under the surface. And, you know, he's incredibly brave.
And also, he did incorporate images of his own childhood into the film as well.
Yeah. Hospital visits, yeah.
Really powerful,
yeah,
too.
Oh, and such a cute little boy, wasn't he? Yeah. You know, with his bright smiles. You know, here he is going for surgery, but he was brave and he did it fearlessly.
Now, one film that we ran out of time to look at this evening.
I know, it was so cute. It was actually The Way He Looks, which opened the MQFF 2015 Film Festival. And it's a gorgeous teenager love story about a blind boy who falls in love with a new boy in town who's in his class. And it's such a cute film.
It is a cute film. And it's won numerous awards, hasn't it?
It has. I think it's won 23 awards and 14 nominations. So if that doesn't tell you, just how good a film it is and how well people like it.
The Way He Looks.
Yeah, it's a brilliant film, a Brazilian film.
Well, rivals your short film in terms of award winning.
Thanks for the plug.
Anytime. No, that's a great film too. I think, you know, there's only really a handful of films that represent queer people with disabilities. So if anything, what we've seen tonight is that there just has to be more.
That's right.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.